You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. The time now is about approximately 6:30. And our next program is Dr. Mike's Health and Wellness. And I'd like to welcome you to this program where we have about an hour to talk together. My name is Dr. Mike. I'm an MD and a naturopath and a teacher of meditation. I have another program on this station on Monday from the hours of 6 to 8. And that one is called The Awakening of the Self. It's more to do with spiritual awakening. But the purpose of this program is to educate you so you can take charge of your own health. You can restore your health if you've lost your health, and you can preserve your health if you still enjoy good health. We believe here that knowledge is power, and knowledge plus action is extraordinary power. That's what we'd like you to have. And in the long run, we'd like you to be free of the control from the drug companies through your doctors in white coats, who they are. The only education they ever receive is drug medicine in medical school. And the drug companies are so powerful, have so much money, that they have taken over the medical education, and they've also bought the hearts and souls of the people running around in white coats. They're not as pure as the white coats they wear. In fact, they're, to a large extent, they're more or less dinosaurs. They practice dinosaur medicine. Well, drugs may be okay for a short term, but they shouldn't be the first line of defense nor the last line of defense. And unfortunately, most doctors are completely ignorant of nutritional values and how to use food and lifestyle changes to enhance the health of individuals. We have a phone here that you can call in at any time to discuss any aspect of health, 831-427-3772. If you grab a pen and paper, I'll read that number out again to you in a minute or two. It's a good idea to write down the notes that what you hear on this program, so you have a reference. Otherwise, it's easy to forget things. I suppose our slogan on this program is based on science-based medicine, and that is to slide away from an animal-based diet to a more of a whole plant food-based diet. That's where science shows all the health is, and less sickness is in that arena. So you can take your time, or you can go as fast or slow as you want to, but you need to slide over, decrease your consumption of animal products. That's meat, eggs, milk, dairy, and slide over to a whole food plant-based diet. Okay, if you have that pen and pencil, the number is 831-427-3772. All right, I'm not sure if there seems to be a problem here with one of my computers. That is the one that plays music. Let me try again. The last time I tried it, I didn't get the music coming through, so I'm not sure. I'm not quite sure. No, for some reason it's not coming through. I'm not sure what the technical problem is, but in any case, hopefully my other computer is going to work. This is the one with the different talks on it. So I'm just basically setting that up right now. And the first program we have is by Dr. T. Collins. I forget what Collins. Dr. Colin Campbell, exactly. He's written a couple of books called his most famous one is called The Chinese Study. He's an MD and a doctor and a scientist, and he's going to talk to us about some of the aspects of our diet right now. Oh, yes, I'm having trouble with this one, too. I'm not quite sure what's going on here. Sorry, I'll just have to keep talking to you for a minute till I see if I can locate the problem. Testing 1, 2, 3. No, I haven't. I think my voice is coming out, but the other ones are. Why aren't they coming out? I'm not quite sure what's happening here. Yeah, I wish I could find the problem. Yeah, it's just coming out very faint, and I'm not really sure why that is. Hold on a second till I check something.
Talking about prescriptive drugs, by the way. At the present time, 9 out of 10 people 60 years of age.
Maybe we got it back there
are
now.
Are consuming at least one or more prescription drugs on a regular basis. I'm not one of them, by the way.
Okay, we'll start that talk again, actually. Okay, I think we've solved the problem. So, sorry about that. We'll proceed from here.
I'm here to talk about health. Your health, my health, the health of your families, friends, especially our children. I'm actually here to talk about health, in fact, of our country. But talking about health, thinking about how we can get health, we are in a system today that is not exactly to our liking. I think many of you would probably agree that we have a healthcare crisis. 18% of our gross domestic product is accounted for by the money we spend for taking care of our health. In this country, the United States has the highest per capita healthcare costs in the world. We're twice as high as the next highest country. But in spite of all this money that's being spent, the quality of our health care, we've got to really face it. The quality of our health care in this country, according to the statistics and health indicators, we place us near last or last among similarly economically developed countries. On top of it, we've got another problem, too. We've got more than 50 million people who don't have health insurance. And that's up 40% just in the last decade. This is a fantastic business model, I think you would agree. It really has been. A lot of people are making a lot of money. But as far as health, it's not a good health model. In terms of looking to the future, what's likely to come because of this problem we presently have, if the tripling of childhood obesity during the last decade, or the last 30 years, is any indication, we're not going in the right direction. Especially when we think about, too, the invasion of our children by type 2 diabetes. Used to be called adult onset diabetes. We might as well put the children thing in it, too. Or the 83% increase in a harsh drug like Ritalin in our children during the last 4 years. Something's not quite right. I'm talking about prescription drugs, by the way. At the present time, 9 out of 10 people 60 years of age and older are consuming at least one or more prescription drugs on a regular basis. I'm not one of them, by the way. And I'm more than 60. Neither is my wife taking drugs. Prescription drugs costs, on the other hand, have doubled in the last decade, and that's after we take into consideration adjustment for inflation. And on this particular point, as much as we are using prescription drugs these days, it's sort of the centerpiece of our healthcare system. It turns out it's the number 3 cause of death. Some would say number 4, depending on how you divide up the first 3. But in any case, you don't see this listed in the causes of death in most of the popular reports. Something's missing. Something is missing from our system, and that's really what I want to talk to you about. I'd like to suggest it's nutrition. We don't understand it. It's confusing. And on this question concerning nutrition, let me just do a little defining here, if I may. Nutrition, if we think of it biologically, is actually using food to maintain health and prevent disease. And the typical diet that we now, in my view, believe is the healthiest possible diet is the so-called 80-10-10 diet. Namely, it's the nutrient composition having to do with 80 parts carbohydrate, 10 parts protein, 10 parts fat on the basis of an energy basis. And that translates into a practical message. What I'm talking about now, it's a whole food, plant-based diet with little or no of the three devils, oil and fat being one, sugar and salt. That's the diet that really does create optimum health. And on that question concerning nutrient composition, by the way, nutrient composition is the index. It's the characteristic of food that best defines its effect on us in terms of health. And in terms of this nutrient composition question, antioxidants, complex carbohydrates, and vitamins, those are the key elements that really give rise to health. They're all found in plants. That's what plants really are. Plants make these things. Animal foods don't make these things. We might see a little antioxidants in animals from animal-based foods from time to time, but that has to do with the animals haven't eaten that kind of thing before they were slaughtered. Fat and protein are essential elements, absolutely essential elements. But it turns out that plants have around 9-11% or so of their on average. Animal-based foods have quite a bit more. So there's the distinctive difference between animal and plant-based foods. There's another class of foods that's crept into our society too in more recent decades that has to do with processed foods. Processed foods, their nutrient composition is all over the map. It depends on how one combines pieces of the other groups of foods. Processed foods also are not good because they tend to be very high in salt, sugar, and fat, the three devils. So I come back to my main point, it's whole plant-based foods that really are doing the job for us. Now, when people think about whole plant-based foods, we've known for a good long time, our grandmothers told us, our mothers told us, that it prevents future disease. But it's not only about using this diet to prevent future disease, and here is the kicker. Here's the thing that really matters that the public tend not to know. It's also about using this same kind of diet to actually treat existing disease. And I think this is a really important concept because it goes right to the core of what our healthcare and medical care system is all about. Here's a list of diseases, for example, that one can find in the legitimate scientific literature, in the peer-reviewed literature. Here are diseases that have been documented to be affected by a whole food plant-based diet. That is to say, this kind of diet prevents, suspends, that means stops the further progression, or cures all of these diseases. We can now cure heart disease in fairly.
I can read those list of diseases out here that food affects these diseases. Cancers, heart disease, multiple sclerosis, kidney stones, osteoporosis, diabetes 1 and 2, rheumatoid arthritis, obesity, colds and flu, macular degeneration of the eyes, hypertension, acne, migraine, lupus, depression, Alzheimer's disease, cognitive dysfunction, erectile dysfunction. So all these diseases are either caused or influenced by food. So, and there's more than that, but that's some of the basis. Okay, great. We'll carry on now.
Late stages, we can cure type 2 diabetes in a very short period of time. I have spent more than 50 years in this field as an experimental researcher, if you will, in the area of nutrition. And I want to share with you a little bit about where I came from and why I think the way I do now. It's controversial for some, but nonetheless, I really believe in the data that we've obtained. Initially, I was involved in investigating nutrients on a one-by-one basis, and still today, that's the way research tends to work. Looking at one thing at a time, just one thing at a time. But over the years, I finally came to the view, and this is really where the punchline is here, this is where the power of nutrition really exists. Nutrition should be recognized as the holistic effect of countless nutrients involving countless diseases, working through countless mechanisms. Now I want to share with you just some, as I look back and sort of ask myself, how did I sort of get to this place? Because I didn't start here in my career some 50 years ago. And I want to share with you just a few observations that were taken from my own research quite a number of years ago now, 30, 35 years ago, that kind of set the stage in a way for developing some principles that apply to what nutrition and health really is all about. This model I'm going to be telling you about in the next three or four slides here involves a laboratory animal model, laboratory rats in this particular case, that have been genetically programmed to get cancer. And so let's see what do we see. I'm interested in this particular case here to see what effect nutrition might have on that model, where the genes are there to create the disease. When we feed, in this particular case, an animal that has the ideal levels of protein, that being about 20% of total protein, when we feed a diet that is 20% diet of protein, these cancers are growing well in the first 6 weeks in those animals. In contrast, when you feed a diet of 5% diet of protein, they don't, even though they've been genetically programmed to get the disease. This next little bit of this next observation really struck me as being quite significant. Namely, when we watch these sort of cancers growing in the first stage and switch the diet back and forth between 20% protein and 5% protein, you can see it there. We could get to a point where we could turn on and turn off cancer development, which is a very exciting concept. Because it basically says, in this case it's protein, but basically in a more general sense, it shows that nutrition controls cancer development. Very exciting concept. Instead of thinking about genes causing cancer or carcinogens causing cancer or viruses causing cancer, well, I'm talking about here in this particular case, nutrients, nutrition, basically controlling cancer development. Now, it turns out that the protein that we were using up until a certain point in time, didn't pay a lot of attention to it because it was a protein that was available for us, was casein. Casein is the main protein of cow's milk. Why is that important? Well, soy and wheat protein, for example, does not increase cancer development like does casein. Here's a couple of plant proteins not doing it, one animal protein doing it, a major difference between the two. So it suggested at that particular point in time the hypothesis that maybe animal protein would promote cancer and plant protein would prevent cancer. And that came down as a fairly general statement that I was to carry through much of my research. It turned out that's the bifurcation that really led to this distinctive differences between these two different kinds of foods. Now, as I say, this is a little troubling for me personally at the time because actually I was raised on a dairy farm. There's me up front maybe, I think it's about 9.5 years ago or so. And another just sort of sidebar story here before I go on. I talked about casein, dairy, and so forth. And so we have a lot of evidence now that dairy is a troublesome food, a very troublesome food, not just because of what we found with respect to its ability to increase cancer. But, you know, my family, we don't use dairy anymore, haven't in some time. And I suggest if we want to do it right, you know, get with the program. So let's come back then to the model that I was using just to tell you about some of the principles that in fact affected me and my thinking in a larger context as we went forward. Namely, in this particular case, we're looking at just not that 5%, 20% kind of thing, but we're looking at a range of protein concentrations in the food to see what happens. And you can see here that in the lower levels of protein, dietary protein from 4 to 10% in this particular case, it's not the exact amounts I'm really concerned about here. It's the inflection that I want to talk about. But with up to about 10% dietary protein, what you can see is that protein is doing its good thing. It's not creating cancer. It's not promoting cancer. Protein is an essential nutrient. We need it. Everything's working fine. So what I'm talking about here is when we consume it in excess to the amount we need. And in fact, most of us humans actually live in that red zone where we're consuming in excess of what we need. So that 10% is enough, really is enough. And that actually is provided by a diet made up of whole plant-based foods. If we're consuming a diet of whole plant-based foods, we're actually getting the ideal levels of protein. We don't need more. But unfortunately, 95% of us, according to the National Statistics, are consuming in excess of what we need, and we do that by actually consuming animal-based foods. Now, I want to just take you to just another little idea here coming from these experiments that I found very interesting. I'm just a little schematic, so just treat it as a schematic. I've just sort of given you two clusters of cells. One cluster of the red cells, those are the ones, let's propose, they're the genetically programmed cells to give rise to cancer. The seed has been planted. The mutagenic event has occurred, okay? Those are the cells that are programmed to get cancer. The blue cells are normal cells. So on the left, we've got a high dose, let's say a high dose of genetically prone cancer cells. On the right, we've got a far less dose, just a little bit. Now, if all else is considered equal, if nothing else has changed beyond that point, obviously the one with the highest dose of the genetically programmed cancers are going to get more cancer. Fair enough. The ones on the right get less cancer. So in that particular case, it's legitimate to say that genes cause cancer. All diseases really start with genes at some fundamental level. So in this case, we can say genes cause cancer. Sort of makes sense. However, look what happens when we get to that stage. And now, our genes are constant over a lifetime, more or less. But we go beyond the genes. If we look in this particular model here, it turns out that if you take the cells on the left, where there's a very high degree of genetic concentration of the cells, feed them the low protein diets, you get less cancer, not more. In other words, you completely just switch it. So what really matters here is not the genes. What's mattering in this particular case is the expression of those genes. That, in turn, is controlled by nutrition. And that is really one of the most fundamental properties of nutrition across the board, not just in this particular model, but in this particular model, it was actually a key. It was a key. It was a lead-in, in fact, to a larger consideration. So nutrition controls cancer genes. It controls genes across the board. It's really quite interesting for all kinds of diseases. And so we can say nutrition trumps genes. That's my view, and we have lots of evidence now to really make that point. It's something we can do about rather than something we can't do anything about. And it turns out there's a list of these same diseases, again, that all basically start with genes controlled by nutrition. So I have a question in a current conversation we're having now. If nutrition controls genes, then why are we spending so much money for genetic research? In my estimation, it's a rough approximation, we're spending at least 100 times the amount of funding for genetic research than we do for nutrition research. When in fact it's nutrition that actually gives us the health. It's not the genes. Genetic research, of course, makes money. Or at least there's the perception of those who are making this money available that in fact it's doing that. Nutrition research only makes health. So it comes down to this. how do we understand nutrition? As I said in the beginning, it's about looking at one nutrient at a time. And we see that every day. The recommended dietary allowance is this nutrient, you need this much, food labeling. It's actually led to a vitamin supplement industry, as a matter of fact. A 30 plus billion dollar industry. We now know that nutrient supplements really don't do the job. That's not what we need. I like to say, let's call that an old paradigm. The practice of medicine is the same sort of argument. At the present time, our health system, our medical practice system, is reductionist in nature. We think about single causes, single biomarkers. You go to the doctor, he tells you how much cholesterol you have, how much blood sugar, as if these are really things that count and all by themselves. Or single diseases, that's how we give them this international classification of disease code. Doctors get paid according to what they diagnose. By our thinking of health in terms of one thing at a time, in a very narrow little context like that, what it means is, okay, well, now we're going to find one thing to cure things. We make drugs with all their side effects. That becomes the primary means of health maintenance. So I'm going to suggest we're at the threshold now. We can be at the threshold now of actually transforming the entire healthcare system and think of a different way. Think about what we can do, and that's really about nutrition. There's countless, as I said, we have to think about nutrition. This is a real challenge to the way we do research and the way we think about things. Nutrition is not a one-on-one kind of thing. It's a collective thing. We call it holism, a holistic kind of idea. It's really, quite frankly, is anathema as far as the scientific community is concerned. So that's at least my experience. But that's what nutrition is, many diseases, working as a symphony. And interestingly, this is simple. It's very complex biology, but it's a simple solution. Just decide what we should put in our mouths. A whole food plant, which has vegetables, fruits, grains, and legumes. Don't add back to oil, fat, and sugar. It's a lot cheaper. It really works. And as far as coming back to my initial thesis is concerned, we now have information, empirical data, to actually show that if you take a group of people, I've been involved in a couple of these tests now. If you take a group of people, give them the right food, the things that happen to us, whether we have a disease or not, are remarkable. You can see these things within a week or two. Cholesterols go down, body weight drops off. And I'm going to say that should be the future of medicine. Or let's say, I don't like the word medicine. Let's say it's the future of food and the future of our health. Thank you.
Okay, that was Dr. Colin Campbell speaking about the application of food to health. He did a large study in China, and he wrote a book about it. It's called the China Study. It's a well-known study in the medical field. He himself is a medical doctor, and he's worked in Singapore, I think, and the Far East. Okay, well, this brings us to my computer that didn't work a minute ago. We're going to try it again, and if it doesn't work, we'll skip over it. You know, I don't have any electrical engineer here in the studio with me. It's just me and 100 or 1,000 buttons and levers. So let's see what happens when I try to play some music. Let's try a little music, a fun music. It's an Irish kind of a song, but it's fun. Ah, yeah, it's working now. Actually, I had some help. Somebody rang in and advised me, thought the earth wasn't properly earthed. So thanks to that gentleman.
done? And what would you do if he died on the ocean? What would I do? Only marry again. Babies are born, the herons are roasting. Kitty lie over, close to the wall. You to be drunk and I to be sober. Kitty lie over, close to the wall.
Okay, that was a song from the Chieftains. It's an Irish group, and I think it's called "The Frost Is All Over." It's a funny song. Anyway, we'll now move on. I've heard the argument over the years that vegetarians may not get enough protein. They've put that to the test, and it shows that they do indeed get more protein than their body needs. You know, an interesting thing about protein, it's made up of 8 to 10 essential amino acids. And those amino acids, wherever you get them from, plants or animal, they are the very same chemical formula, structures. The only difference is in animal, there may be more, in the proportionally more of one amino acid than the other. And the same with the vegetarian proteins. But essentially the proteins are the very same structures. And the only thing I think with animal product is, I've been to a slaughterhouse at least twice, and those animals know they're going to be killed, and they're pouring out adrenaline into the meat. And when you eat the meat, you're getting the effects of that adrenaline, and it becomes a stimulus for a lot of people. And it could be that people are addicted to that stimulus, that the adrenaline that comes with the meat from when the animals are killed in the slaughterhouse. All right, we'll move on to this talk now. This is Nutritional Facts, and this is...
...plant-based diets recently compared the nutrient profiles of about 30,000 non-vegetarians to 20,000 vegetarians, and about 5,000 vegans, flexitarians, and no meat except fish eaters, allowing us to finally put to rest the perennial question, do vegetarians get enough protein? The average requirement is 42 grams of protein a day. Non-vegetarians get way more than they need, and so does everyone else. On average, vegetarians and vegans get 70% more protein than they need every day. Surprising that there's so much fuss about protein in this country when less than 3% of adults don't make the cut, presumably folks on extreme calorie-restricted diets who just aren't eating enough food, period. But 97% of Americans get enough protein. There is a nutrient, though, for which 97% of Americans are deficient. Now that's a problem nutrient. That's something we really have to work on. Less than 3% of Americans get even the recommended minimum adequate intake of fiber. So the question isn't where do you get your protein, but where do you get your fiber? We only get about 15 grams a day. The minimum daily requirement is 31.5, so we get less than half the minimum. If you break it down by age and gender, after studying the diets of 12,761 Americans, the percentage of men between ages 14 and 50 getting the minimum adequate intake, zero. This deficit is stunning, in that dietary fiber has been protectively associated with the risk of diabetes, metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease, obesity, and various cancers, as well as high cholesterol, blood pressure, and blood sugars. Therefore, it is not surprising that fiber is now listed as a nutrient of concern in the dietary guidelines. Protein is not. One problem is that most people have no idea what's in their food. More than half of Americans think steak is a significant fiber source. By definition, fiber is only found in plants. There's no fiber in meat, dairy, or eggs, and little or no fiber in junk food. Therein lies the problem. Americans should be eating more beans, vegetables, fruits, whole grains. How are we doing on that? Well, 96% of Americans don't eat the recommended minimum daily intake of beans. 96% don't eat the measly minimum for greens. 99% don't get enough whole grains. Look at these numbers. Nearly the entire U.S. population fails to eat enough whole plant foods, and it's not getting any better. A lack of progress that's disappointing. Even semi-vegetarians, though, make the minimum for fiber, and those eating completely plant-based diets triple the average American intake. Now, when closing the fiber gap, you want to do it gradually, no more than about 5 extra grams of fiber a day each week until you can kind of work your way up, but it's worth it. Plant-derived diets tend to contribute significantly less fat, saturated fat, cholesterol, foodborne pathogens, while at the same time offering more fiber, folate, vitamin C, phytochemicals, all essential factors for disease prevention and optimal health and well-being. And the more plant foods, the better. Whole plant foods, the better. If you compare the nutritional quality of vegan versus vegetarian, semi-vegetarian, pesco-vegetarian, and omnivorous diets, traditional healthy diet indexing systems, like compliance with the dietary guidelines, consistently indicate the most plant-based diet as the most healthy one.
Plant-based diet is the most healthy one. All the scientific studies are showing that. So try to absorb that into your consciousness. And because later you may want to do something, you may want to act on that. If your goal is prevention of
when
disease...
When 300 acres of New York City waterfront
hold
is
on
making
a second, I've got an ad coming.
And Goldman Sachs brings together people...
Sorry, I got to deal with this. It's... Okay, let's see now. All right, we got... all right, we start with one. It's to do with eggs again. Most people are under the impression that eggs are good for you. This is science.
So the egg industry created a national commission on egg.
I'll just go back to the beginning of that.
For decades, on the basis of concerns from the American Heart Association and consumer groups, the Federal Trade Commission carried out successful legal action, upheld by the Supreme Court, to compel the egg industry to cease and desist from false and misleading advertising that eggs had no harmful effects on health. See, anti-cholesterol attacks on eggs resulted in severe economic loss through a reduction in egg consumption, so the egg industry created a National Commission on Egg Nutrition to combat the anti-cholesterol, anti-egg publicity with ads like this, exclaiming there is no scientific evidence whatsoever that eating eggs in any way increases the risk of heart attack, which the U.S. Court of Appeals found patently false and misleading. Even the tobacco industry wasn't that brazen, instead just trying to introduce the element of doubt, arguing that the relationship between smoking and health remained an open question. The egg ads made 7 claims, each of which, in truth and in fact, was determined to be bull. The court determined the egg industry ads were, and are, false, misleading, deceptive. In fact, legal scholars view what the tobacco industry tried to do as the same as what the American Egg Board's Nutrition Commission on Egg Nutrition tried to do. As with the egg ads, the tobacco industry did more than just espouse one side of a genuine controversy, but just denied the existence of scientific evidence. Over the last 36 years, the American Egg Board has spent hundreds of millions of dollars to convince people eggs are not going to kill them, and it's working. In combination with aggressive nutritional science and public relations efforts, research shows that the advertising has been effective in decreasing consumers' concerns over eggs and cholesterol heart health. This is from their internal strategy documents I got a hold of. Currently, they're targeting moms. Their approach is to surround moms wherever they are. They pay integration fees for egg product placement in TV shows. To integrate eggs into The Biggest Loser, for example, could be $1 million. But getting some kids' story time reading program to integrate eggs may only take $500,000, though. The American Egg Board keeps track of who is and is not a friend of eggs. They pay scientists $1,500 to sit and answer questions like, what studies can help disassociate eggs from cardiovascular disease? From the beginning, their arch nemesis was the American Heart Association, over which they fought a major battle over cholesterol. In documents retrieved through the Freedom of Information Act, we see even the USDA repeatedly chastising the egg industry for misrepresenting the American Heart Association position. In a draft letter to magazine editors, the egg industry tried to say that the American Heart Association changed its recommendations to approve an egg a day in 2000, and eventually eliminated its number of restrictions on eggs in 2002. To which the head of USDA's poultry research and promotion programs had to explain the quote-unquote change in 2000 wasn't a change at all. Nothing in the guidelines or recommendations was changed. What happened is that in response to a question posed by someone planted in the audience, Heart Association reps acknowledged that even though eggs are the most concentrated source of cholesterol in the diet, since an individual egg has less than 300 milligrams of cholesterol, technically an egg could fit under the 300 milligram daily limit. And in 2002, they just eliminated the specific mention of eggs for consistency's sake. But the American Heart Association insists that they haven't changed their position and continue to warn consumers about eggs. Here's from the AHA website at the time. If one egg has 213, and the limit of dietary cholesterol intake for people with normal cholesterol is 300, you could fit in an egg if you cut down on all other animal products. Right? You can have an egg for breakfast, and then if you had some coffee, some skinless turkey breast, etc., you could end up 510. Right, nearly twice the recommended limit. So if you're going to eat an egg, you need to substitute vegetables for some of the meat, you drink your coffee black, and you know, watch for hidden eggs in baked goods. And the limit for folks with high cholesterol is 200 milligrams a day, which may not even allow a single egg a day. This is how the Senior Director of Nutrition Education at the American Egg Board's Egg Nutrition Center characterized the American Heart Association guidelines. Maybe I'm being overly sensitive, but this reads like if you insist on having those deadly high cholesterol eggs, your penalty will be to eat vegetables. And you can't even have that yummy steak and creamy coffee you love. Really, it's not worth eating eggs. Oh, and if you think you'll be able to enjoy some delicious baked goods, forget it. The deadly eggs are there too. Concern has been expressed about the fact that cow's milk contains estrogens and could stimulate the growth of hormone-sensitive tumors. Concern that the consumption of dairy products could both promote the conversion of precancerous lesions or mutated cells to invasive cancer and enhance the progression of hormone-dependent tumors. This was initially postulated based on suggestive population-scale data, like this, a 25-fold increase in prostate cancer in Japan since the war. What was happening to their diets during that period? A 5, 10, 20-fold increase in eggs, meat, and dairy consumption, whereas the rest of their diet remained pretty stable. But you know, diet wasn't the only major change in Japanese lifestyles over the latter half century. Similarly, even though countries with higher milk consumption tend to have more prostate cancer deaths, and countries with lower milk consumption fewer deaths, there could be hundreds of confounding variables, but it certainly does spur interest in studying the possibility. This recent study represents the other extreme, controlling for as many factors as possible by just isolating prostate cancer cells out of the body in a petri dish and dripping cow's milk on them directly. They chose organic cow's milk because they wanted to exclude the effect of added hormones and just test the effect of all the growth and sex hormones found naturally in all milk. They found that cow's milk stimulated the growth of human prostate cancer cells in each of 14 separate experiments, producing an average increase in cancer growth rate of over 30%. In contrast, almond milk suppressed the growth of these cancer cells by over 30%. But just because something happens in a petri dish or a test tube doesn't mean the same thing happens in a person. It's just suggestive evidence that can be used in a grant application or something to get money to study actual people. There's kind of two main ways that's done. Retrospective studies, looking back, where you take prostate cancer patients and figure out what they ate in the past, and prospective studies, looking forward, where you look at people's diets first and then follow them for a few years and see who gets cancer. The looking back kind are called case control studies, where they look at cases of cancer and compare their diets to controls. And the forward-looking kind are called cohort studies, because you're following a cohort of people forward. Then, if you want to get fancy, you can do a so-called meta-analysis, where you combine all the best studies done to date into one and see what the balance of available evidence shows. Okay, so here we go. The latest meta-analysis of all the best case-control studies ever done on the matter concludes that milk consumption is a risk factor for prostate cancer. And the latest meta-analysis of all the best cohort studies ever done also concludes that milk consumption is a risk factor for prostate cancer. An even newer study suggests that milk intake during adolescence may be particularly risky in terms of potentially setting one up for cancer later in life. Despite hormone-related cancers being among our top killers, as pointed out in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, we simply do not know which hormones and how much are in the food we ingest. More effort has been directed at the investigation of illicit use of designer steroids by Olympians and ballplayers than to the investigation of the effect of dietary hormones on cancer and other diseases that affect millions. A proposal is therefore made to monitor levels of steroid and other hormones and growth factors in all dairy and meat-containing foods, though to date this has not been done.
Oh. Okay. You know, prostate cancer is very common in men. I think it's the second highest cancer of all cancers. And milk, even with that, even organic milk, without any added hormones, which they do add, and antibiotics and different things, just organic milk was tested and found to be promote cancer 30% more. So I myself stopped drinking milk or dairy products, and it might be right for you to do as well. You don't want to end up with cancer. Okay. All right, let's see what we have next.
Most nutrients per dollar. If you look at a graph of affordability. Sweet potatoes can be considered a superfood.
This is about the anti-cancer potential of sweet potatoes.
One day, perhaps even off the planet, as NASA has chosen it for space missions. One of the healthiest and cheapest. The study aimed to identify which vegetables provided the most nutrients per dollar. If you look at a graph of affordability versus nutrition, you can see that the healthiest foods, like dark green leafy vegetables, may also be among the cheapest. And the highest nutrient-rich food scores per dollar were obtained for sweet potatoes. They're not just packed with nutrition, but may have special cancer-fighting properties. In 1931, a unique protein was discovered in sweet potatoes, later renamed. 80% of the protein in sweet potatoes is a type of protease inhibitor with potential anti-cancer effects. It was originally tested against leukemia cells and appears to suppress the growth of leukemia cells in a petri dish, but how would a sweet potato protein ever get into our bloodstream? As soon as most proteins hit our stomach, they start getting digested. So they tried sweet potato protein against tongue cancer. Sweet potato constituents certainly come in contact with our mouth. Tongue cancer is often treated with chemo. However, most of the chemo drugs for tongue cancer have great aversive side effects, so it is indispensable for us to find other therapeutic strategies. Sweet potato protein rapidly diminished viability of the cancer within a matter of days, leading them to propose that sweet potato may be useful for human tongue cancer, but presumably not much else. Remarkably, though, this class of proteins doesn't just survive digestion, but may be absorbed into the bloodstream intact, in at least two of the nine women with advanced cervical cancer they tried giving it to. So, most recently, it was tried on colorectal cancer cells, one of our most common and deadly cancers. Normally, we just surgically remove the colon, but that only works in the early stages, since there are often micrometastases outside the colon that can subsequently lead to cancer recurrence and death. And so we've started searching for anti-metastatic agents. And not only does sweet potato protein slow down the growth of colon cancer cells, but decreases cancer cell migration and invasion. Though sweet potato consumption has been associated with lower gallbladder cancer rates, it's never been directly put to the test. But what's the downside?
Now we have coming up flaxseed versus cancer. So this will be an important one to remember, to listen to and remember.
Prostate cancer rates. The incidence of clinically malignant prostate cancer is highest in African Americans, some 30-fold greater than in Japanese men, and 120 times greater than seen in Chinese men in Shanghai. Well, in general, the Western diet is one in which animal protein and fat consumption is high, whereas the fiber intake is low. In contrast, the proportion of the total caloric intake from animal fat in the more vegetarian-style Oriental diet is low, and the fiber content is higher, so maybe diet is playing a role in some of these diseases. But these healthier diets are not just low in animal proteins and fat and high in starch and fiber. They're also rich in weak plant estrogens. This study, for example, found higher levels of phytoestrogens in the prostate fluids of men in countries with relatively low rates of prostate cancer. In vitro studies have shown lignans can slow the growth of prostate cancer cells in a petri dish, so a pilot study was launched on flaxseed supplementation in men with prostate cancer before surgery. Why flaxseeds? Because while these anti-cancer lignans are found throughout the plant kingdom, flax seeds have up to 800 times more than any other food. So they took a bunch of men with prostate cancer about a month before they were scheduled for surgery to get their prostates removed, and started them on a relatively low-fat diet with 3 tablespoons of ground flaxseed to see what effect it might have on the growth of their tumors. And though they were skeptical that they would observe any difference in tumor biology in the diet-treated patients, with such a short-term dietary intervention, just within those few weeks, they found significantly lower cancer proliferation rates and significantly higher rates of cancer cell death. Now, this was compared to so-called historical controls, meaning compared to the kind of cancer growth one typically sees in their situation, not to an actual, randomized control group. But a few years later, a study was finally published in which men could act as their own controls. These were men that just got their prostates biopsied and were scheduled to get a repeat biopsy in 6 months' time. So they did the same thing. After the first biopsy, they reduced the fat in their diet and put them on ground flax seeds to see if it, made their repeat biopsy look any different. These were men with what's called PIN, which is like the prostate equivalent of ductal carcinoma in situ in the breast, an early stage of cancer. That's why they were getting repeat biopsies, to make sure it wasn't spreading. And this is what they found: significant drop in PSA levels, which is a biomarker of prostate cell growth, a drop in cholesterol, which is what we'd expect with a lower-fat diet and all that extra fiber, and importantly, a significant decrease in the cellular proliferation rate. In fact, in 2 of the men, their PSA levels dropped so much they didn't even have to go through with the second biopsy at all. There hasn't been much research on this kind of precancerous prostatic hyperplasia, with only 4 epidemiological studies reported at the time. They yielded varying findings, with increased risk associated with higher energy protein and animal product intake, and decreased risk related to consumption of alcohol, fruit, and green and yellow vegetables. In sum, a low-fat, plant-based diet high in phytoestrogens.
All right, that means if you have a PSA, a high PSA, or if you're concerned about your prostate, you should make sure you include in your diet lignans from the flax seeds, and also lycopene from tomatoes, especially cooked tomatoes. Lycopene and lignans from flaxseed. These will tend to lower your PSA and stop the progression of cancer. All right. Let's see. Maybe we got some music now. Let me just have a look here. This is Luciano Pavarotti. And he's singing Ave Maria.
Thank you.
Okay. Scientifically speaking, meat eaters are at much higher risk for developing cancer. And this is mediated through IGF-1. That's glucose factor 1. In meat eaters, it's 18 times higher in the blood than in vegetarians or vegans. And this hormone stimulates the growth of cancer cells. Cancer cells are all the time being formed due to mutation and natural mutation and chemical mutation and other kinds of mutation. They're being formed in our body. Some people say 30 or 40 or more a day. And our immune system has to deal with that and gobble them up, as it were. So that's why it's reducing cancer risk in meat eaters is an important idea. Of course, it's better to cut down on your meat, and especially certain kinds of meat, so that you reduce your risk. All right, so this is the next piece coming up.
The cooked meat carcinogens implicated in promoting the initiation, growth, and spread of breast cancer may also increase the risk of prostate cancer. The mechanism through which the consumption of well-done meat may increase prostate cancer risk is via the release of mutagenic compounds during cooking. The heterocyclic amines and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are chemicals formed when the muscles of mammals, fish, or birds are cooked by high-temperature methods such as pan-frying or barbecuing. And in chicken, we just found out the temperature doesn't have to be that high. Just baking at about 350 for 15 minutes leads to significant production of heterocyclic amines, including FIP. So it's not just frying and grilling, barbecuing. These cooked meat carcinogens have also recently been associated with increased risk of kidney cancer, colon cancer, lung cancer, and pancreatic cancer, which is not a cancer we want to get. How do we decrease our exposure to these potent mutagens? Well, fried bacon and fish are the worst. Interestingly, chicken without skin had higher mutagen levels than with skin, which may act as an insulating layer for the meat. Now, medium rare is less mutagenic than well done, which may be why women in the Iowa Women's Health Study who consumed meat very well done appeared to have nearly 5 times higher risk for breast cancer than that of women who consumed meat rare or medium done. But this raises the so-called paradox of preparing meat, noted by the Harvard Health Letter. Well-cooked and you risk cancer, undercooked and risk E. coli. Eating boiled meat, not broiled, but boiled in water, is probably the safest. If you eat meat that never goes above 212 degrees Fahrenheit, both your urine and feces are significantly less mutagenic compared to eating meat cooked at higher temperatures, meaning you have less DNA-damaging substances flowing through your bloodstream and coming in contact with your colon.
Okay, that's it. You just got to be careful with your meat. If you're a meat eater, you got to be careful that you don't get E. coli and that you don't get heterocyclines and other cancer-forming agents from overcooking meat.
Okay, so we now know how to prevent diabetes. How do we treat it?
Next one's about diabetes.
There's lots of different drugs for diabetics that lower their blood sugars, but often at the expense of increased risk of heart failure, heart attacks, and bone fractures. There has to be a better way. Just like with heart disease, the same diet that prevents the disease in the first place can reverse the disease once you have it. You put 20 diabetics, for example, on even a near-vegetarian diet, and in 16 days, half don't even need to take insulin anymore, and those who do are on half the dose. and that's after only about 2 weeks. A randomized, controlled clinical trial put the official American Diabetes Association diabetic diet versus the vegan diet head-to-head. The ADA diet slowed the progression of the disease, such that their diabetes was just a tiny bit worse at the end of the study period. But on the vegan diet, their diabetes actually got better, significantly better. Just think how many lives eating vegan could save, how many lives, eyes, kidneys, feet, and families.
Okay, we'll just go one more, and then we have to bring it to the end.
My name is Dr. Michael Greger, founder of the nonprofit website nutritionfacts.org. Every year I read through every issue of every English-language nutrition journal in the world, so busy folks out there don't have to. And I compile all the most interesting, most groundbreaking, the most practical findings into new videos and articles I upload every day. To the website, everything is free, no ads, no commercial sponsorship, not selling anything. In fact, all of my proceeds from my books, DVDs, speaking engagements, all goes to charity. I just do this as a public service, and actually all goes back to my grandma, who when I was a little kid, was diagnosed with end-stage heart disease at age 65, confined to a wheelchair, crushing chest pain, already had multiple bypasses, and sent home to die. And then she heard on 60 Minutes, Nathan Pritikin. She's one of his first patients. They wheeled her in, and she walked out and lived another 31 years on this planet with her 6 grandkids, including me. And that was the day when she came out that I knew I wanted to be a doctor. But then in medical school, they didn't teach. I mean, by then, Ornish had published in The Lancet Lifestyle Heart Trial, reversing our number one killer without drugs, without surgery. And If that didn't get out there, if the cure to our number one killer, then what else was there in the medical literature that I didn't learn about in medical school? That there wasn't a financial motive, there wasn't a corporate budget driving its promotion out there, and so I made it kind of my life's mission to go back into the literature and look at this incredible mountain of research. It's not like it isn't there. It's not like the studies haven't been done. Now, in the age of the internet, now people can take their life and their health and their family's health into their own hands and educate themselves. They don't need to rely on so-called professionals. The low-carb movement keeps coming back over and over again in different faces, and each of them swears, oh, no, I'm not like the last low-carb. We tweak it a little bit. But they're very similar manifestations, and of course they sell lots of books. Any book that says bacon is good for you is going to sell a lot of books. But, what troubles me is, this isn't an academic debate. This isn't an academic discussion. Who's right, who's wrong? It's people are going to listen to these and actually hurt themselves, hurt their families. People are going to die. What's their number one cause of death? Number two cause of death? Go down the list. These are largely diet-related diseases, and to tell people to eat these kind of diets it's not that it's not based on science. The science is the opposite. This is not the Dr. Greger diet versus the Dr. Atkins diet. It's the science. It's centuries of science versus the latest fad that someone wants to sell books over. And it's ironic to me that, the foundation of these theories tend to be that, carbs are bad because they increase insulin. And insulin, having high levels of insulin associated with cancer, associated with lots of bad things. But, meat is insulinogenic. There's a paper by Holt and colleagues, 1997, American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, called, in fact, you can look it up, it's probably free by now, Insulin Index of Foods. And it says you eat this much of, and they went through about 50 different foods, and eating beef causes a greater spike in insulin than white potatoes and white pasta and white rice. More insulin, and if that's the villain, right, then you'd stay away from the meat. Even using their own framework, you would eat the opposite thing. And, I mean, the cause of prediabetes, the cause of type 2 diabetes is insulin resistance. What causes insulin resistance? It's intramyocellular lipid. It's fat that's inside the muscle fibers that interferes with insulin signaling such that your body has to keep pumping insulin to try to force it into your muscles, which use up about 85% of your blood sugars. Your blood sugars rise because they can't enter into the cells. And not just any fat, but particularly saturated fat is toxic. So it's called lipotoxicity. And that's the term that's used in the literature to describe the effect that saturated fats have on the insulin, on producing insulin resistance. And we can do this. It's not just epidemiological studies. The studies back 1927, they took these medical students, put them on a high-fat diet, and within days, their insulin sensitivity dropped. They had twice the blood sugar spike to the same meal that people that were on the kind of high carbohydrate. Twice the blood sugar response, just 2 days eating these fatty foods. And we now know, and now we do these lipid infusions. You can actually infuse fat, and within hours, we can see insulin resistance appear, blood sugar start to go up, your body has to churn out that extra insulin, and we have fancy drugs that can actually pull fat out of your system, and insulin resistance drops. And it doesn't have to be in the vein. The fat can go in your mouth, too, and we have the same thing. And the effect is almost instantaneous. Literally within days, or within hours, within days, we can get this insulin resistance, and that is what leads to these diseases. Now, diabetes is the seventh leading killer. It's an epidemic. It's now becoming a pandemic around the world as developing countries are starting to take on the rich Western diet. And it's just an absolute tragedy. And they're telling people to eat exactly what's causing the disease. In fact, that's why obesity is associated with diabetes, because you can get fat in your bloodstream, which gets in your muscles two ways, either through your mouth or your fatty tissues. Actually, there's what's called a spillover effect. Actually, your adipocytes, the number of fat cells you have after about age 20 is about the same. The reason your butt, thighs, and stomach gets bigger is just your fat cells actually fill up with fat. They swell. You don't get more fat cells. They just get bigger. And when they stretch to a certain point, they start spilling fat over into your bloodstream, and that gets lodged in your muscles, and that can spill over, get lodged in your liver, and cause insulin resistance in your liver, make things worse, and then can actually lodge in the pancreas, in the insulin-producing cells of your pancreas, and then you can actually get that same lipotoxic, that fat toxicity, in your pancreas that reduces the amount of insulin you can produce, and then you're in florid type 2 diabetes, and which is the number one cause of blindness, number one cause of non-traumatic amputations, number one cause of kidney failure in this country. These are horrific complications. What does modern medicine have to give them? Just trying to reduce the complication rate. Just not treating the underlying cause, and we can cure this disease even years into the process, which is really exciting. It's not like, we used to think, we just kind of kill off these insulin-producing pancreatic cells, but it's actually maybe we're just kind of suppressing them. We can actually kind of wake them back up if we actually eat a cleaner diet, reduce that fat. Diabetes is a disease of fat toxicity in our organs, in our muscles, in our liver, in our pancreas. My mission in life is to help make people make evidence-based, science-based decisions as to what to feed themselves and their families to prevent, treat, even reverse chronic diseases that are laying waste to our society. I put all my work up free, nutritionfacts.org, and the science points to a diet centered around whole plant foods.
Okay, so we now know how to...
Okay, that brings us to the end of the show. I enjoyed being with you for the last hour, even though I had some technical problems to deal with. It's not fun when they come up. We don't have any engineer here to sort problems out. You've got to try to sort them out yourself as best you can. I did have a gentleman ring in, give me some good advice, so I'm grateful to him. But anyway, we have to we've come to the end of the show. And so I do hope you've made some notes about what we talked about and apply. You got to apply the knowledge to your life to improve your health, okay? And that's all about flaxseed and your pancreas and your prostate cancer and other useful bits of information. And if you tune in every week and make some notes every week, you'll find that you'll become an educated person about your health eventually. And so you are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 on the FM dial. And this show is Dr. Mike's Health and Wellness. And you can also stream this radio station at freakradio.org, all one word, freak, F-R-E-A-K, radio, freakradio.org, and press the red button on the image of the tower that comes up on your computer screen. And you can do that with your smartphone or your computer. And if you want to access the archives of this show, you go to radioforall.net. Radioforall.net. For all is the numeral 4, forall.net. And in there you put the name of the show on the right-hand search engine on the right margin of the page. And in this case, you put in Dr. Mike's Health and Wellness, M-I-K-E-S, Health and Wellness. If you want to access my other shows, you put in The Awakening of the Self. And then I had an older show, which was called Health and the Awakening of the Self. So that now you have three different titles to put in there. And that was most of the clips that I played tonight was from Dr. Michael Greger. You heard him talk at the end there. He's an MD and he researches the medical magazines for the different information about foods and other stuff. And all his stuff is on YouTube. And he doesn't charge, or he doesn't. He's not in cahoots with any kind of personal interest with the food people and stuff. So it's pure. It's pure information, science-based information. And of course, there's different opinions out there on eggs and other types of food, but we try to stick to the science, the objective science. All right, good to be with you again. We'll hopefully see you next Monday from 6:30 to 7:30 on Dr. Mike's Health and Wellness. Okay, bye for the moment. We'll see ourselves out with a little music. Just